know, if you walk out waiting for someone to tell you what to do, you don't worry about quitting a job, you won't get a job.
And it's always good to get right to the point. And that was my friend and colleague Bruce Dixon making a comment on the world of work. And I am Will Richardson. Welcome back to the Modern Learners podcast, number 23, I think, as we spend about 45 minutes this evening talking about how jobs are changing, how the culture of work is changing, a pretty far-ranging conversation around what the future looks like, if we can even come close to telling what that looks like. And then also a little bit of a reflection on our second cohort of Change School. Don't forget, if you are at all interested in Change School, you can go check us out at change.school. That's the web address. Our third cohort begins in about 1 month from now, around September 6th, and we would love to have you join us. Or you can find us also at modernlearners.com and also at our Modern Learners Change Leaders Facebook group, which is a private group. We've got about 2,700 people in there now having some interesting conversations around how the world is looking and changing and what we need to be thinking about in terms of our work with kids. So anywhere you can find us, we would love to have you guys engage with us. But for now, thanks again for coming back and listening to this podcast. This is a pretty interesting conversation around what work looks like and how we have to start thinking about it for our kids. Thanks for listening.
Hi, Will. How are you?
I'm doing great, Bruce. How is the rainforest?
The rainforest is spectacular, mate. And no matter where anyone else in the world is, I would strongly suggest that a visit up to far north Queensland is a really worthwhile one. I'm north of Cairns in Queensland. My wife nearly stepped on a 3 or 4 meter snake yesterday and
really
came across a really large goanna, which is a very big lizard, which is about 3 or 4 meters long. But other than that, life's really good.
Now, what's that? There's that big kind of ostrichy-like bird that runs around up there that's very rarely seen, right? What's it called again?
Cassowary.
Cassowary. And
oh, yeah.
Do you know that on my visit up to Ken, my one time up there, which was an amazing trip, I saw one of those actually running into
the bush. That's a rare. They're very rare. And you also don't go up and pat them too.
I didn't get anywhere near that thing.
It's a
big bird.
It's got a big spur. It's got a big spur on the back end of it, and that foot gets you. It doesn't pat you. It makes a bit of a mess. Anyway, so this is a pretty interesting part of the world, but it's been good to come up here and chill and think and a little bit of reading, a little bit of reflecting. So what about you? What have you been up to? You still traveling?
I've been on the road a little bit to Texas, and there's going to be a big announcement coming out of the Richardson House in the next couple of days, which I divulge, but I'm not going to. has nothing to do with me. Well, actually, it does have something to do with me, but nothing about the work. So it's been really good. You know, I was just wondering, I'm this may be the first podcast from the rainforest in northeastern Queensland. What do you think?
Could well be, mate.
Well, we'll see.
I think it's a fairly good chance for those people who are actually watching us on Facebook that it may well be
have absolutely no lives. They right now. As always, thank you so much for coming to watch us if you're here now, and really appreciate you coming back to watch us if you're watching this after the fact. But anyway, that's Bruce in the rainforest. There he is.
That's.
So what are we chatting about, Bruce? What's up?
Well, I don't know. I thought, as I think some of our viewers and listeners will know, we've had a rather busy 8 or 9 weeks just wrapping up the last Change School. And during that, you posted a really good article. I think the challenges, everyone, frankly, I think you put in there as a provocation, and it certainly made people sit back and think about what they called the quitter economy or the quitting economy. Yeah. And I thought that might be a good topic for us to lead with, because it certainly checks everyone's assumptions about work and work lifestyle and what we expect of our young people today.
With the caveat that we don't really know if that's what the economy is going to look like or what's going to happen. And hardly anybody does know, have a clear sense of the way it's going. But that article was really interesting. And it said that basically you should go into employment with the mindset now that you are going to quit your way to a better job, which I thought was really...
Hang on, Will. Yeah, when you say that, Say that again. You're going to quit your way to a better job.
Yeah, because what you're going to do is you're going to go and spend some time on a particular, you know, in a particular line of work, whatever that is, and you're going to learn a lot. And in the process of learning, you're going to prepare yourself for the next job that you get. So it's not just about making money any longer when you are on the job. It is about learning new skills and whatever else you need to go out and get that next job, which is also then to get the new skills and whatever else you need to get that next job and so forth, which I thought was really interesting. And before we just kind of kick it back and forth, the one part of it that I found really interesting was when they were talking to the bosses of this new generation of people who are coming in and who are taking the job with every intention to quit. And the bosses were saying, well, it's really our job to make sure that you do get those skills and do get that stuff, whatever you need, so that you are successful at your next job as well, which I thought, I mean, you know, from an employee standpoint, it's a culture shift, but from an employer standpoint, that's just a huge revision of the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah, and it's sort of, in a way, it's the next iteration of the gig economy, isn't it? You know, this notion that you just take on jobs when they're available and you move. And as absurd as what you've just been describing sounds, I've actually quoted and talked with young people about that three times in the last 5 days.
Really?
And they're on board. I mean, one of them is my daughter and two other people. And they said, yeah, that's the way it is. I mean, as the article says, the only way really you can find your value is to apply for another job. That often you don't realize, you know, just what skills you've developed, what abilities you have until you go to somewhere else and they say, wow, you can do that now. Well, we're really keen to have you here. So you only get your value when you're on the market rather than staying in a job and waiting for someone to identify that you've actually got these skills.
I do get the sense that there's a little bit of a difference between what we're talking about here and that thing that's called the gig economy.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
You know, because I think what we're talking about here is that you take actual full-time jobs. You're on the job for, you know, 40 hours or however many hours a week that is, but it's full-time employment that you're choosing to undertake, as opposed to the gig economy, which is basically I'm going to deliver food on, you know, for 3 hours a night, and then I'm going to drive Uber. And then I'm going to go and basically work as a hotel clerk or something. You're going to just kind of mash together all these different types of gig, short-term contract type of work.
Your short-term contract. I guess I was thinking of like the developer who gets on a project, does it for 6 or 9 months, then moves to the next project, which is very much how many of them do it, which is that's the long story of the gig economy, and it runs in sort of. I mean, I know we're stretching the label language, but I think it's the same thing.
But I think people have stretched that label to include a whole bunch of stuff that really is more than the way we think about gig, right? When we think about a gig, I think most people probably would say a short-term project or a short-term contract, not a part-time job type of thing. A little bit different. So you're right. I think we have to make sure we get the language correct on that.
Yep.
And by the way, the gig economy, even though everybody's talking about it and saying this is the new way, you know, that you're going to make a living and whatever, it's not necessarily a great way to make a living. In fact, there've been a couple stories of late that pushed back on that whole concept and said that, you know, in many ways, we're giving up a lot in order for the supposed freedoms that we get from, you know, working in those ways. But
I think there are a lot of misconceptions about that, as you said. And frankly, there's a lot of exploitation going on. You know, there has been we've seen instances of it in a number of places. And I think that people have, as you said, you know, freedom, autonomy, you know, on the other side, you lose a lot of coverage.
Did you see the ad for Fiverr? And this has been in the news a lot. This has gotten a lot of buzz. So Fiverr, for those of you who don't know, Fiverr is a place.
Oh, sorry, Fiverr. I know what you mean.
Yeah. So you can go online. It's, I think, Fiverr.com, Fiverr, I think, .com. And basically, it's a whole bunch of artists and graphic designers and whatever else, technicians, programmers. And it's the $5 job, basically. You can bid on if you need a business card or you need a voiceover or whatever. And it's really cheap. It's like $5 or less. And to be honest, we've used Fiverr a couple times and it's been amazing. I mean, the value that you get from that, because there are a whole bunch of people in the world, not to mention, but that $5 is quite a bit of money, you know? And so that's the difference now, is that you can connect to all of them. But Fiverr put out an ad, and we'll find it and put it in the show notes. Fiverr put out an ad, and it was a close-up picture of this girl's face. And she looked almost like she was a drug addict. It was very kind of dark and whatever. But the pitch was, you know, you don't sleep very much. You only eat when you have to. You kind of live from apartment to apartment. You're perfect for Fiverr or something like that. And they were trying to say, if you're, I know, right? If you're really flexible and you don't need a lot, then, you know, you should be someone who does this gig thing on Fiverr. But the reason a lot of people pushed back was because the picture was a representation of a girl who looked like she was just being emotionally and physically abused, you know? So it's interesting that it's not all wonderful, as is the case with a lot of this stuff. People talk it up. A lot of people are wondering they're suggesting it's not such a great thing, you know, that it's not a great development.
Yeah, I think that, as always, these ideas come up and we get all excited about it because, again, take the other extreme of Fiverr, I'd go to something like 99 Designs.
Right.
And 99 Designs is a legitimate, really well-run organization that essentially you bid for work, as you do with Fiverr, but you do it through a contest. It's for designers, for people who don't know. It's mainly for art and design, for web page design, for usability design, whatever else. And I've used it quite a number of times. But, I mean, there you're paying, well, you could be paying thousands of dollars. But essentially, rather than going to the design house, and I find this frustrating, you go to a design house and they might give you two graphic artists who say, here's some options for you. With 99 Designs, you can put up and say, I'll pay $1,500 for a logo, and 30 or 40 people from around the world can bid on it. I think the pointed task here, which is the relevancy of it, is when you talk about globalization, this is, globalization writ large. I mean, this is the real, because of those 40 or 50 people who bid, the very good chance that 30 or 40 of them don't come from your country, no matter where you are.
And it is on a local level, though, too, right? Uber
and
Airbnb and TaskRabbit and all sorts of these other services and businesses where you can make money off of what you own. I think I forget what the name of it is now, but there's, people, just like Airbnb, now you can do the same thing with people's cars, right? So if you fly into an airport and they'll pick you up and you can take their car and bring it back 2 days later and, you know, it's just like renting, but it's a lot cheaper and it goes right into the pocket of the person who owns the car. Just to be clear, this is a little bit different from where we started this conversation, which was about this kind of quitting thing, which I think we should get back to. But I think both of these types of new cultures of work have implications for us as educators, you know, and have implications for the way that we think about our kids, because certainly not every kid is going to end up in a position like that. But I certainly could look at my kids and think that they're going to be moving through a number of jobs. They're probably not going to be in long-term positions. I'm not sure that's a bad thing. It's a different thing in a lot of ways, but I think that, it's definitely a conversation we need to be having.
Well, certainly, more than anything, it says, you better be a learner.
Absolutely.
Because
that's right.
I think that's
the whole deal.
Yeah, it is.
I think that's the whole point of the quitting thing. It's not a quitter, it's not with the quitter society. It's the learner. I think you could say it's the learner society in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that that's the whole point. I mean, the title, the headline of the story certainly is provocative, but underneath it, it's about trying to help people reflect on, what is important. And within schools, it says, if you come out of school and you think you've done your learning, you think that the first job you're going to get is what you're going to get for life, which is what people of our generation or older certainly thought, that's well and truly gone. And you very much are going to be valued on what you do, not so much what you know. It's what you know, do with what you know, that really counts. And therefore, you better be sure about, where you're investing your time. And most importantly, you better ensure that of all the skills you can have, you better be a great learner.
Absolutely. And so what does that look like in classrooms, do you think, Bruce? I mean, what do teachers, what do educators, schools, how do we think begin to think a little bit differently in terms of preparing kids for that type of much more chaotic, much more kind of messy path to a profession or a job or whatever else?
Well, the first thing I want to say, mate, is I think it presents an immediate challenge to teachers because they, in their profession, in their role, largely are in no way touched by anything we just talked about. Now, to an extent, the only reason they could be is if, certainly in the last 3 to 5 years, in both of our countries, Australia and America, a number of countries, teachers in many places are put on contract work and they literally are working year to year. But I think the temporary or the unpredictable nature of employment, the need to continually be gaining new knowledge, new skills, isn't something that's confronted teachers in their profession very often in the past. And so it's very hard, I think, at the start for teachers to go, really, you know, this is the world that you're all going to move into. It's not a world that I'm in. So I think the profession itself has to identify that this is something that they will have personally, something they'll find difficult to adapt to. But once they do that, I think then the need then is for teachers to understand that this is about this agile world, this idea that, you know, there isn't a concrete amount of knowledge that we can pour into kids' heads and they can walk out of school and but get a job for life. I mean, that is way past us now. And so what we have to be focused on is this notion of continuous learning. It's across all the professions now. And it's not just when you're, you know, in the quitter society, it's this notion of needing to be continuous learners and ensure that, you know, kids are confident learners, that they're able to adapt and that they're able to capitalize on those skills that they have and use them to the best of their ability. But within the classroom, that certainly should change the dynamic in a huge way.
So a couple things on that. Number one, just kind of on a side note, I was in Killeen, Texas earlier this week, and I was talking to a bunch of folks there about the kind of situation with teaching. And what shocked me was that they said in some places over 50% of all teachers who are in the building were there through alternate route, meaning they had not taken teacher kind of traditional teacher preparation programs at schools. They don't have degrees in education. And that they were there pretty much because of shortages, that they can't get enough teachers to fill those spots. So they're taking people from industry. And I talked to one woman who said out where she was, which was in Western Texas, that her kids went through high school with probably 75% of their teachers not being traditionally certified teachers. And
what?
Yeah. And when you think about that, it's nuts. It's crazy.
I choose my doctor the same way. I don't want him to be.
Nice. Gracious for me. So, but there's nothing they can really do about it. And because they simply cannot get enough teachers out in those remote areas and in a lot of different, I guess in a lot of different places, but even in Killeen, I think there was a significant number of people who in one of my sessions, I asked how many people had come through that kind of alternate route, and probably about a third of the hands went up, which was pretty interesting. So that's kind of side point number one. But the other thing I wanted to say was, you know, as you're talking about what changes in the classroom and how the role of the teacher changes, it kind of goes back to the Shifting Conversations column that I wrote for this week that just came out through the newsletter today, and talking about Jane Hart, who is one of the people who I follow very closely when it comes to workplace learning and just learning in general. And she wrote a post about the modern learning advisor and kind of how interesting, what an interesting kind of shift it is to think about the adult in the room or the person who is the learning professional, which obviously we would think is the teacher. But that person would be moving to have a lot more influence and a lot more emphasis on creating these types of learning opportunities. So just really fast, Things like the roles would be to help students grow their networks, help students keep up to date with their interests and passions, help students manage their own self-development, help students manage their own learning personally using their own tools. So, you know, all sorts of things like this that we wouldn't normally, I don't think, assign to a traditional teacher, but I think would create environments and cultures in schools that would allow kids to become much more comfortable and much more adept at navigating the type of work or employment scenario that we're talking about, that they would be more flexible, more self-determined, more dependent on their own dispositions and skills rather than kind of, again, waiting for someone to teach them how to do that stuff. So I found that really, really interesting.
Yeah, I thought the article was a really good one because it really brought to the front that if we don't give kids the confidence to be self-directed learners, the skill sets to make these decisions about what and how they should be learning, if we don't do that, frankly, you know, we're de-skilling them. I mean, the sorts of environment we started this podcast, talking about, just those sorts of people, whatever it is, webinar, we'll call it everything. Those sorts, you know, if you walk out waiting for someone to tell you what to do, you don't worry about quitting a job, you won't get a job. Right. And that's the real problem, because in schools we have, you know, largely been responsible for telling kids what to do, when to do and how to do it. And sure, we've been in modern learning, and through the newsletter and through Change School, we're talking a lot about the need to be more self-directed, self-managed, self-something, whatever you like, autonomous learners. Well, this isn't just a riff off a simple idea or a cliche or something, a fad that's floating around. This is the world. This is the real world. This isn't a passing phase. You know, we have an obligation to give kids the ability to be self-directed in the choices they make in their life, and most particularly the choices they make around their learning. And if we don't fulfill that obligation, then we're being negligent in the profession, frankly.
I think the hard part is, well, there's a lot of hard parts to this, but yep. I think one of the hard parts is that it is just so different and so uncertain.
Yep.
And it does take me back to, I think it was AJ Giuliani who, I'm sure other people have said it too, but you know, don't prepare kids for just college and career, prepare them for anything. And I do think that that's the mindset that we have to have in education.
Yeah.
We can't predict any longer. Not that we ever could, really.
Nah.
I think we had a pretty, let's say that the dartboard was a lot bigger back then. You know, you could throw the dart and it would probably hit something. You know, you'd probably be pretty close to what kids needed in terms of what you were doing in classrooms. Now I think, you know, it's just, it's very hard to figure out what the skills are, what the dispositions are, what the knowledge base is. I mean, we keep going back and forth on this all the time. And I've come so far to the opinion that we have to focus our work on kids' ability to acquire tacit knowledge as they work, as they live, you know, to be constantly learning rather than be so focused on this explicit curriculum that we keep trying to deliver. And that's repeated. I mean, I'm reminded of that over and over again. And I may have said this before in a recent episode of this, but, you know, I've started asking teachers how much of what they do in their classrooms did they learn in pre-service school and in their pre-service program. You know, and how much of it was learned on the job. Yep. And everybody knows that almost all of it you learn on the job.
Yep.
Which I guess is why it's not that bad that you have a whole bunch of people coming in who haven't gone through that pre-service education program, although there certainly are some teacherly skills or educatorly skills and pedagogies that I would hope everyone would at least think about and read about and talk about. You know, constructionist pedagogies and all that type of stuff. I mean, I can't imagine someone just walking out of, 25 years as an accountant walking into a math classroom cold without any sense of what learning means or how it happens in kids. You know what I'm saying? But having said that, just really fast, having said that, I just, again, believe that most of that you learn on the job anyway, right? It's one thing to be able to talk about constructionism or constructivism or, you know, fill in the blankivism. But it's only when you really start to try to create those types of opportunities in classrooms that you learn what it's about.
Yeah, mindful of the email you received from someone who just got a hold of our latest white paper around 8 books that we're recommending for people, a few others. And I mean, that's how we do our learning. And it doesn't matter how what we learn at college or university, it's what we keep abreast with and how we make sure that our learning does continue. But I'm with you, though. I mean, I'm all for teachers going and having other experiences when they leave school, because, you know, I think it's a good thing. But I'm also very frustrated by the rationale for us having people coming to teaching who don't have any background, being that we didn't know that was going to happen. We've got a shortage. I mean, you've got at the moment in some states in US, all around the world, we've had this. Do you know which country doesn't have it? Singapore. Do you know why?
You're going to tell me.
Two words. Manpower planning. Do you really think, sit down and think about it and think, if the toughest thing you had to do in the world was predict the number of teachers we'd need 2 years hence, 5 years hence, you'd look at birth rates, you'd look at death rates, you'd look at migration rates, you'd look at whatever it takes. It isn't that hard. It's just, you know what it is? It isn't a priority.
No,
not a priority to plan this out. And it's certainly not a priority, just to finish on the point you made, it's not a priority for any government, any policymaker anywhere, to ensure that even kids in remote areas, in challenged areas, in areas that are hard to find teachers for, that you can't recruit people for those jobs.
It's in the States, and you know, maybe we'll segue into our kind of second topic after this, but in the States, I think, as you know, part of the problem, if not most of the problem, is that teaching doesn't pay. I mean, you almost can't survive as a teacher if you have two kids, you know, and you need to pay for daycare and whatever else. I mean, there are literally some places in this country where you can't do it. You can't make it work.
So the answer is?
The answer is that we have to have more of a commitment culturally to education, and we have to see it for the public good that it is. But unfortunately, in times where, you know, there's so much of an income gap, there's this growing income gap, obviously, between people who are really rich and they can take care of their kids, so they don't worry about public schools. And then the people who don't have the money, they can't contribute to that in any greater degree. We're in a really bad spot right now. And unless there is some will on the part of society to raise the profession and treat it as a profession and pay it as a profession,
absolutely,
I don't know how we get around this. And and as you know, there are a lot of people who are not upset at all that this is the case, that they would like to get rid of teachers and unions and schools, and you know, there are a lot of people with a lot of money who don't care if this is happening.
Yeah. You know, that's a problem that we talk about often. I know many people do, and I think it's one that as a society we have to focus on and stop putting it in the back burner. And I think, you know, our focus certainly in the last, well, this year and certainly in the last 9 weeks has been around supporting those leaders in schools who want to do something about this for the young people they've got in their schools. And I think the experience of the last 9 weeks has been another exciting phase in our lives. For the conversations that we've had with the people who've been part of Change School too.
Yeah, and so we had a SpeakPipe voicemail from one of our Change School Now alumni, since we had graduation on Monday night, John Clements, who we're happy to say was named the Massachusetts Principal of the Year this year.
Yeah, well done, John.
Well done, and who was someone who pushed our thinking and who obviously wanted to learn more as we went through the last 8 weeks.
Hi, Will and Bruce. This is John Clements, principal of Nipmuc Regional High School in Upton, Massachusetts. Thank you for taking my question. I'm fortunate that I had the chance to recently wrap up my experience in Change School 2. I felt really fortunate to be part of a community of learners and leaders who were so committed to the idea of rethinking schools in order to embrace modern learning. My question has to do with seeing that experience through both of your eyes, You've had the chance to work with cohorts from Change School 1 and 2. In addition, you've had the chance to interview so many impressive educational leaders through the podcast. Wondering if I can prompt you to reflect a minute on those experiences and talk about some of the themes that have emerged about how educational leaders make change actionable for their schools, moving from that idea of blue sky thinking to where the rubber meets the road in order to make change actionable for our modern learners. Thanks.
So I don't know, Bruce, if you want to start just talking a little bit about what you kind of learned over the last, that's been 6 months now, or yeah, about 6 months. And what some of the big takeaways have been for you?
I think, as you said, I mean, I think we've both been saying this is some of the most rewarding times of our career because of all that, because of the quality of the conversations and the dialogue we've had with these people, because part of the, you know, the secret, the magic, I think, of what we're doing in Change School and the format we have is the community we're building. And so it isn't just what you and I and Missy seem to think about, you know, these topics. We've now got over 100 people who are doing substantial work in a whole range of areas in a huge demographic mix and also across many geographies. And we're learning from them. And I think what I'm really hearing clearly is that, you know, firstly, we've all been talking about change for way too long in schools. And, you know, you get change fatigue and whatever else. But all the change that we've talked about has really been, frankly, quite superficial. It's either been the change that says we're going to build a new building or we're going to get some new technology, or it's the change that people want to see because the school's failing. You know, we don't, just what we were saying then, you know, we can't get enough teachers, we can't pay them enough, we're in a, you know, economically challenged environment, we want to change that school because of the economy that that surrounds it. And none of that really gives you the basis on where to start, because it's built on the existing foundations, the existing philosophies, the existing assumptions we make about school. And so the foundations that you're going to build that sort of change on is never going to sustain significant change. All it's going to do is reinforce the existing practice and the existing model of school.
Right.
And I think what we found, and I think certainly the first 3 or 4 weeks of Change School, the leaders who joined us were surprised that we weren't going down the same path. That we said to them, can we take a step back? Can we go right to the heart of this? Can we really start talking about what we need to better understand before we start talking about the process of change? What's the philosophies on which we're going to build this? What are the principles around which we can talk about Change School? And that's when we started talking, and people who listen to our podcasts and will be familiar with the topics around learning, around the context, the modern context, and the impact that has on our young people's lives, and the implications that has for what we do in schools in exactly the same way we've just been talking about in this podcast. And we spent the best part of 4 weeks on, I don't know how many hours of video on Zoom talking about that. And then you start laying down some solid foundations on building a new model, on looking at what does it actually take to put in place a different view, a different perspective around what school could and should be. And if you do that, if you can lay down those beliefs around what learning should look like, what is important in the lives of our young people in the modern context, then you give yourself a real chance to build a sustainable model of school that is relevant, that is worthwhile, and responds to the needs of our young modern learners. And I think that, you know, over the period of time we had people together with us, I think they went on that journey, and many of them, I think, understood the need to rethink the starting point. You know, we don't start by talking about computers or technology or buildings or putting an adjective in front of learning, flipping it or blending it or whatever else. We go back to tools. We go back to the basics of what you believe about learning.
I think there are three things that stick out to me. Number one, when we first started talking about doing this, we both came to this because we were tired of not having an answer to the how question.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, both of us, when we started talking about this with Missy too, and I still am not sure that we have answered the how question, but I think we're a lot closer to it than we were.
Yep.
And it is because we've had these people who have been willing to, kind of take a take a journey with us. And, you know, we keep saying it's not a course, it's not a curriculum, and it's really not. It's just inquiry and asking those questions. And no one who tells you that they know how to change schools is telling you the truth. Mm-hmm. Because it's excruciatingly hard work. And
it's unique to every school.
It's unique to every school, to every leader. And that's the only way that you can go about it. And I've just found that the willingness of some of the people, and look, you know, we'll be honest. I mean, we've had over 120 some people who have signed up, and there've been a chunk that for whatever reason have not participated, just like you're going to have that with any group and any cohort. But the yep. vast majority of people have, and those who are participating at a really high level, it's profound, you know, and I've been struck by their willingness to be vulnerable, their willingness to be honest, their willingness to push and question one another. That's why this has been among the, you know, it's we've said this before, you know, it's the best work that I've done. And it's because the level of the conversation is just, it's much higher than it ever has been in the past. And then the last part of it is, and I think I knew this, but I was still struck by how isolated a lot of these people feel in their yeah. attempt to make change happen. And I think that's been one of the most powerful things for many people who've been doing this. So, you know, despite that, all saying all of that, this is still, like I said, it's still very hard to do. And I think that while most people who have gone through the Change School with us would say that it has opened their eyes, that they feel a lot, they have a much greater sense of depth to of understanding as to what it takes and where to start and how to kind of think about it and lead it and all that kind of stuff. We're still trying to figure out exactly how to make that move from that understanding to practice. And what I'm looking forward to as we move forward is seeing more and more examples of people who have taken what they've learned in Change School, applied yep. it in their own schools, and made it work. And I know that many of the people who we've been with over the last 6 months are going to make it work. And yep. And that's what's really, really
and
exciting.
And I'm making it work because we've been very fortunate yep. that, yep. you know, absolutely. I mean, I don't know what the number of schools would be, but we've got a significant number of schools that are well down on this journey. They're not people who are thinking about it or who are mapping out a playbook about what they're going to do. These are schools that are doing the work. I mean, the most obvious one would be our friends up in Peel in Canada. But, you know, there are many, many other schools that are on this journey with us that are along the way. And I think you phrased it. Do you want to talk a little bit about your notion of the in-between, you know, that we're at this point of in-between?
Well, this is it's a very difficult moment in education. And, you know, we both say that people who aren't feeling that difficulty or feeling that pressure or challenge or discomfort aren't paying attention because the narrative is changing. I was just watching actually a video earlier today from a professor at Wharton who is running a part of some type of Reimagine Ed contest and yeah. going on for 4 or 5 minutes about just how higher education is absolutely at a moment where it is going
very much so.
It has to change. So we're between stories. I think that, again, I'm not sure that, I know I'm not the originator of that phrase, but I forget where, it may have been Lee Crockett actually who said it, but it really resonates with me because the traditional story I just believe is breaking. And the new story really hasn't been written yet. Our friend David Warlick was someone who talked a yep. lot about that, you know, a number of years ago. What is the new story and telling the new story? And we spend a lot of time on that in Change School as yep. well. But what we're doing is we're writing a different story, which is very cool. And it's fascinating to me.
And I think also it's interesting when you reflected on, you know, I mean, we spend so much time in these with each of these cohorts. And we're reflecting very much on how they participate, how they contribute, who contributes. And I think that we also have a number of people who come onto Change School and are caught by this notion of what we think high bar is, because I think a lot of people, despite what we say on our website and when we talk to people, I think they're a little taken by the, no, Wes, this is serious. I mean, we aren't just going to play around at the edges here. And so I think they go off and want to reflect on it. And at the same time, we have a number of people we know who come back the second time. We've had, goodness me, it'd be quite a number, a percentage of people who say, look, I did Change School one, and frankly, there was too much there. I was overwhelmed, a little bit intimidated by can I come back?
I started two, and I was like, my brain started hurting. Can I come back in three? Yeah. I was like, sure. It's lifetime membership, right?
And that's the whole point, because as you said, as this develops, as we hear more and more stories about what this looks like, and as people get more of a chance to share those stories, it starts to fill in the gaps for people. Stuff. And the one I want to highlight, because I know it came across in Change School, is an interesting one. The one good example of the specifics of when the rubber hits the road, which is the point that John made, is, you know, okay, look, let's agree on all this. Let's say this is this notion of inquiry, of being curious, of you know, the shift in pedagogy and practice is important. We understand all that. So what's it look like for five-year-old kids? You know, okay, we understand what this looks like in the high school. I actually had this discussion in a breakout on one of our Zooms about 5 days ago. You know, we understand what that looks like for 12-year-old kids, 14-year-old kids, but you know what? It's really hard for 5- and 6-year-old kids, because they've come to school to learn to read and do those sorts of things. Now, I totally understand and empathize with that question. What I find ironical is that for some of our schools that have worked with us, they're thinking the opposite. They can work the K through grade 3 thing out. They're looking at it and saying, well, I don't know how you do this in 14 and 16-year-olds, because, you know, I reckon it'd be pretty hard to all of a sudden take kids who have been used to a delivery of knowledge content type strategy or pedagogy to all of a sudden, you know, be trying to explore big questions and go to a very different classroom environment. So what I'm saying is that the answers are there, but putting them all together in the place where they make sense to the people who want them can be difficult. Yeah. And so one of the things I know that, you know, we're teeing up in this question and discussion and really appreciate John asking is what we found was we need to bring those people to Change School. We need to make them available to the people who participate, to everyone, so that they can share firsthand from people at the coalface saying, hey, you know what I do with five-year-old kids? I know they have to learn to read. You know, when we talk about inquiry, we're not talking about throwing explicit teaching out the door, because that doesn't happen. I mean, that's like, you know, that's like literally throwing the baby out with the bathwater. This is about balance. This is about responding to the children's needs. It's about understanding where they're at, what they need at the time. But it absolutely is about not ensuring that you are, you know, pushing down their throats or delivering information to them in the traditional way, 6 hours a day from the day they start school until the time they leave it. You know, there's a balance there that we've got to find, and how you structure that, how you set that up so that it is, number one, built around your beliefs around learning. That's the thing. And just to finish off, mate, it comes back. I think I might have said this in a podcast earlier. I apologize if I have. You know, my youngest daughter started teaching about 5 years ago, and I remember she's incredible. She's a smart kid. She had a master's and did the whole thing. And she went in. She's going to teach five-year-old kids. And the week before, she panicked. I mean, this kid had done that much preparation. And she rang me up, and she actually was in tears. And she said, what am I going to do, Dad? Where do I start? I've got this curriculum. And I said, just what do you believe around learning? And she goes, well, I know you sent me that Frank Smith book, The Book of Learning and Forgetting, and it told me an awful lot about that. I said, good. Go back and reread it. And when you walk in the classroom, look at your kids, listen to your kids, and respond to them as learners, because that's what matters. That book of stuff you got there, you know what? You're going to get there. That just, you know, you have an idea about where you want these kids to be in 12 months, but you got 6 hours a day, 280 days a year to really work with these kids. You know, make it a place that they enjoy learning.
And that Frank Smith reference is a great segue, because I was, as we close this out, I was going to mention, if you really want to get a sense of where we're at in Change School, We're putting out a new little white paper. In fact, it's out already. You can go to our blog page. You'll see it on the sidebar. But it's called The 8 Best Books for Education for Modern Educational Leaders. And I guarantee you, there's no one in the world who would be able to predict what 8 books are on that list, because they are half of them were written probably 25 years ago or 20 years ago, have nothing to do with modern.
Sure.
And then the other 4 do. But that's the point, right?
Exactly.
It's not just modern learning. I've been thinking about that more and more. You know, we've been doing modern learning now for years, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I still keep coming more and more to the way of thinking that those two things are really separate, and you got to have both of them. You know, you got to get that learning thing, and learning doesn't have anything to do with modern, as far as I'm concerned, at its core.
Unless
you kind of wrap your brain around that, read Frank Smith and some other people who are in that list.
Sarah.
That's only then does the technology become relevant and interesting.
In and of itself,
without that context, the technology is just kind of frivolous. But anyway, so go check it out. And I'm not talking to you, Bruce, because I know you know, we wrote it together. But those of you who are listening or watching, go check it out. It's on our modernlearners.com/blog page. You'll see it in the sidebar. Well, hopefully that was a pretty interesting conversation for anyone who's still listening. Really appreciate you taking us in and giving us some time to kind of ramble on about our thoughts about the world. But Bruce, enjoy your last few days in the rainforest. When are you heading out?
I've got about 4 more days and then we're back.
Four more days. Yeah. All right. Well, enjoy. Stay dry. All right. We'll see you next week. Cheers, mate.
Cheers, everyone. Cheers, Will.
Hey, thanks for listening. And don't forget to come back next week for another conversation between Bruce and me about high bar change in schools. If you haven't read our latest white paper on the 8 attributes of modern educational leaders, you can head over to bit.ly/8attpod and download it. And if you're really getting serious about change in schools and you're a leader who wants to learn how to do that and connect with all sorts of other people from around the world who are doing that, please visit us at change.school, where we're already taking signups for our 3rd cohort that starts in September. So we hope to see you there as well. Have a great week, everyone, and thanks again for listening.